We went through 2 weeks of figures of speech. Then last week, we looked at rhetorical writing, which often contains figures of speech. And, for example, a rhetorical question is a figure of speech. And sometimes, hey, by the way, can you have figures of speech and figures of speech? Yes, you can. In other words, if I have a figure of speech that's built into a rhetorical question, that's double layers of figures of speech. Symbolism, like in Revelation, symbolism that occurs in Revelation will oftentimes have figures of speech built within the symbolism. Example, the Apostle John will say, this is like or as he's describing the symbol. So you'll have figures of speech within a larger figure of speech. Here we have Hebrew poetry patterns, and those differ, by the way, from other poetic patterns, which we'll cover next week. The Hebrews had particular ways in which they did their Hebrew poetry, and it is definitely different from ours, and there are reasons, I think, why the Lord selected that as something that would be in Scripture. So some of those examples you see in the four bullets there, restatement of the same and or similar words in parallel, rhyming and meaning. What is the advantage, or what are the advantages of having meanings rhyme instead of having sounds rhyme like we do with our songs of poetry?
When you translate it, it doesn't get it.
Yeah, you translate it and you maintain the with the meaning. You maintain the meaning once you translate it in your rhyming sounds like we do, then you lose the meaning rhyme. And so, for example, some years ago I was over in Germany at a church over there, and they were singing Mighty Fortress is Our God. Only, you know, it's the same melody, but the words don't have the same meaning, right? You can't just translate it over and sing it. So that's one of them. Here's another one. Restatement of the same and or similar words in mirror image, also rhyming meaning. So what they'll have is not only repeating in parallel, but mirror image. In other words, they'll have something that's kind of like a small chiasm. And we'll go over chiasms as well. The next one is restatement by negation of the opposite as contrast of meaning. Okay, this, and then they'll have not that, right? And then stating the whole by putting together two halves, often with and between the two halves. And we'll talk about what that, you know, two halves makes the whole pattern. The quick example would be heaven and earth. That's the way that the Hebrews would talk about all of creation, heaven and earth, or the heavens and the earth. Right? So they would refer to all of creation or the universe in that way, heaven and earth, put that together. So one of the examples, one of the reasons, rather, why this is a particular advantage is because you can translate in different languages, so they translate, like, for example, the Book of Psalms in other languages, and it still rhymes meaning. Even though in the other language it wouldn't rhyme sound-wise. And so one of the other advantages we have here is restatement also emphasizes because you're repeating something or stating something similar. And then it also helps us with certainty of communication. In other words, let's say I had not a clear idea, okay, what was the first statement? The second or third statement might say, oh, okay, now I get it, right? So you get some confirmation of what was said. So let's take a look at Psalm 6, which you have there. And now I've done something here to make it easier to recognize, and that's that I've kind of changed the formatting, and that's something you won't find. But it is a way to study the Bible, is to look at how do I match things up? So let's take a look there. One of the things I've done is to bold O Lord, where it shows up repeatedly. Okay. That says, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your wrath. What do you see there?
It's a double statement.
So a double statement. So rebuke me and chasten me. Those match up in terms of a negative input. Okay? And then your anger and your wrath. Again, rhyming words. And so here's Psalm 6 is an example, a good example of this Hebrew poetry pattern because it carries all the way through. So, O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your wrath. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am pining away. Heal me, for my bones are dismayed, and my soul is greatly dismayed. So, what you see in the first part, be gracious to me and heal me, those are the pleadings or positive statements, right? And then, O Lord, and then followed with, how am I doing with this? I am, the first line, pining away, my bones are dismayed, my soul is greatly dismayed. Right below there, in verse 3. Now what do you see that says, my bones and my soul? What's that telling you? Where are your bones? They're in the physical side, aren't they? Right? And then my soul is on the spiritual side. So part of what this is doing is saying I'm being impacted both physically and spiritually. Right? Both physically and spiritually. But you, O Lord, how long? Return, O Lord, rescue my soul, save me because of your loving kindness. What's the you, O Lord, how long? What's that question for? Why is there a question there for, Lord, how long? How long for what?
For the suffering or for how long for him to live?
Yeah, for how long before you respond, right? Does the Lord always answer all of our prayers immediately right away with a yes? No. And so that's a common human experience is we're on the time tunnel and it seems like, Lord, you got to do something, but when, So return, O Lord, rescue my soul, save me because of your loving kindness. For there is no mention of you in death and Sheol, who will give you thanks. Now let's ask a question. What does he mean by that? What's Sheol, for example?
Hades.
Right? This is the place of the dead, right? And does that mean that there's no afterlife? Or is that what this is saying? When we have a memorial service, do we mention the Lord? Yeah, we do, certainly. But there's no communication from the dead to us, right? No communication from the dead to us there. Now here's a very interesting set of figures of speech. In verse 6, I am weary with my sighing. Every night I make my bed swim. Okay? Ever see a bed swim? And then I dissolve my couch with my tears. So what's verse 6 telling us?
A lot of hurt,
yeah. Great grief, right? Great grief. And I make my bed swim. What does that mean? That's an awfully curious figure of speech, right?
So many tears.
Yeah, lots and lots of tears. Okay? Lots and lots of tears. And then he says it more literally, I dissolve my couch with my tears, right? So many, many tears. My eye has wasted away with grief. It has. So what has? My eye, right? My eye has become old because of all my adversaries. Now, notice another pattern here. He switched over to my, right? Where above there he had you. Right? So he's looking at himself now, isn't he? So, and then depart from me, all you who do iniquity. He's been talking to the Lord. Now who is he talking to?
His adversaries.
Yeah, the adversaries. Now he gives a word to them, and he switches back to the Lord. For the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. The Lord has heard my supplication. The Lord receives my prayer. So the my pattern again. All my enemies will be ashamed and greatly dismayed. They shall turn back and they will suddenly be ashamed. So you see in this Hebrew poetry pattern, probably Psalm 6 is one of the good earliest examples with lots of that Hebrew poetry pattern. Not all of the Psalms have as much as what you see here. Psalms is Israel's national hymn book. It's 150 psalms. Some of them are short. Some of them are almost unimaginably long, like Psalm 119 being an example. And we're going to be talking later about how do I study the Psalms? Because it's Israel's national hymn book, collected over about roughly a 1,000-year period of time. So it's quite a collection, but it's Israel's national hymn book, therefore what does that tell you? What do we conclude because it's Israel's national hymn book? Does everything in the Psalms directly apply to me? No, so we have to look at it and understand, okay, what does this... How does this apply to me? And that's part of, you know, reason for this elective. Okay, let's take a look here. Top of page 2. So as we said earlier, these Hebrew poetry patterns are not just found in the Old Testament. So here are some instances in Paul's writings where he clearly made this point in the Hebrew poetry pattern. Okay? So we have 2 Corinthians 4, 7 through 11 as one example. So it says, but we have this treasure in earthen vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. So what you see is there's a divide there, and on the right hand side you see kind of the negative outcome. Okay, except there's a negation in it. In the earthen vessels, we are not, it's, the power will be from God and not from ourselves. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Okay.
So that's parallel?
Pardon?
That's parallel.
Yeah, and then that's parallel from one to the next. And if you look underneath there, we have this treasure, the surpassing greatness of the power be of God. And then I put a break in there, verse 8. So we're afflicted. So here's the external thing happening. We're afflicted, we're perplexed, we're persecuted, we're struck down. And then the negation. But it hasn't gotten to this point, right? But we're not crushed, we're not despairing, we're not forsaken, we're not destroyed. So we have this external pressure coming against us, but it hasn't come to some, you know, final destruction. So then we see the next line there, always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our mortal flesh. So what do you see that's just repeated verbatim there?
So that the life of Jesus also may be manifested.
Manifested in our. Yep. And that's, he just goes word for word exactly the same. And then at the end of that, what's rhyming?
Be body and mortal flesh.
Body and mortal flesh at the end of that is rhyming. So he keeps some part of the line the same and then has a rhyming body and mortal flesh statement there. And how about this? Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus and constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake. Okay, so that's a restatement, isn't it? Right? Parallel restatement. So here's Paul. He's writing to the Corinthians, and he breaks off into this Hebrew poetry pattern. But why would he do that? Why would he break into this Hebrew poetry pattern when he's writing to Corinthians? Aren't they all just a bunch of Greeks?
Because there's a lot of Jews here.
Ah, significant Jewish population there. Okay. By the way, Paul didn't always encounter a significant Jewish population. Philippi was one that, you know, you need 10 Jewish men in order to establish a synagogue, and they didn't have that, so they met out by the river. So there isn't always a large Jewish population, but there was a significant group of Jews at Corinth. Okay, so Hebrews 2:19 through 22, and we'll be going through this a little more later to see the pattern through all of Ephesians 1 and 2. So this is just picking the end of it, which is a Hebrew poetry pattern. And by the way, we'll also look at why this is a Hebrew poetry pattern and why does he use it here. So we'll be looking at that. Okay? But right now, we just want to look at and recognize it. So then you Ephesians, are no longer strangers and aliens, and this is strangers and aliens would refer to the Gentiles, the majority among those at Corinth, at Ephesus. but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household. Okay? So, no longer strangers and aliens, but in contrast, you're fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household. Okay, verse 20. Having been built up on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. And by the way, apostles and prophets is a set of words in that order that occurs three times in Ephesians. So it's significant. Here it's the foundation of the apostles and prophets. And by the way, that also tells us something else. Do we have apostles around now? Right? And one of the clues, it's not the only one of the clues is that it's the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Those are the ones who found what is being built up, who start what's being built up. And just like this building, you don't keep building foundation, do you? You build a house, you don't just keep going up with foundation, 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 and foundation. You at some point start building on top of the foundation, right? And the same thing here.
So, Vern?
Yes.
Apostles and prophets, is that two halves of the whole?
I suppose you could take a look at it that way. It's the apostles and essentially those who had the gift of prophecy and those who were their associates work with them. We're not intending to go into the study of spiritual gifts, but you know, we could, but that's another study in itself. So that Jesus Christ himself being the cornerstone. So what they would do is they would dig down, typically with a large building or with city walls, they would go down to bedrock. Okay? So for example, at Jerusalem, they built those walls, they would go down to bedrock and then build up from there. They wouldn't do, as is common around here, where you go and dig down and, okay, 2 feet down is enough, you know, that's good enough, now let's just build. They would go down to bedrock. What were some of the reasons for going down to bedrock?
It doesn't move.
Yeah, it doesn't move. Yeah.
Support,
yeah, okay. For the city of Jerusalem, where it's a defensive wall, what's the advantage of going all the way down to bedrock?
You can't dig in.
Yeah, you can't go undermine it. Because that was a hazard. If you had a shallow foundation that they could dig under, then the whole wall would collapse, and that'd be the way they'd break through, right? So you go down to bedrock, and this thing is solid. It turns out that the perimeter wall, for example, the Temple Mount, they went down to bedrock, and then they used, at the bottom, huge stones. The stones were so big that the Romans, when they were trying to tear down the whole temple and the Temple Mount, they couldn't move them. As a matter of fact, even today, we don't know how, you know, Herod's crews got those in there. The largest crane in Israel could lift the largest stone, but not move it. So even today, we really had no idea. So anyway, they would go down to bedrock, and once down to bedrock, they would set a cornerstone, the major stone that everything else was built off of. Okay? Everything is going to get, you know, set with respect to this stone. And so here it says, Christ is the cornerstone, the apostles and prophets are the rest of the foundation. Okay? That's the word picture here. And then we see in 21 and 22 is where it really drops into a Hebrew poetry pattern. In whom the whole building being fitted together is growing into a holy temple in the Lord. Verse 22. In whom you also are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit. Okay? So you see, identical is in whom. And then the whole building matches up with you also are. And then being fitted together is repeated just verbatim twice. Right? So we got being fitted together in verse 21, being fitted together in verse 22. Now, then we have is growing into a holy temple. And what is a temple? What's another definition for a temple?
Body.
Yes, that's for us. In this case, what you see is into a holy temple is into a dwelling of God. A temple is a place where God dwells, right? And then in the Lord, not entirely equal to, but followed by in the Spirit. So you have a Hebrew poetry pattern in which in whom being fitted together is copied exactly. And then you have, beyond that, some rhyming statements between those. Now, something very interesting. We'll go into more about why Paul said this right here, with the way he did, because we'll be looking all of chapters 1 and 2 of Ephesians. But this one, very interesting. He's writing to Jews and Gentiles, and Ephesus had a significant number, though a minority, a significant number of Jews. What was going on with the temple in Jerusalem when this was being written? They were still rebuilding it. Okay? In 20 BC, Herod the Not-So-Great began the building project. What his pattern was, by the way, is go out and do some horrendous, you know, slaughter and genocide, and then to distract himself by starting another building project. And at 20 BC, he started the rebuilding of the temple. But unlike previously, this was a temple in operation. So it gets complicated, right? And you can't have just any old craftsman coming in and doing some of the work on the inner temple. So they trained as many, over time, as many as 10,000 Levites who were allowed to work on the temple while it was working, right? In various crafts as they worked on the inner temple. And then they'd had other non-Levites working on the other parts, right? But, of course, this all took money, and so there was heavy taxation. And then when they finally got the work done, about 63 AD, they laid off 18,000 men. And then there was a riot. Because they were suddenly out of work, right? But the point being that he's talking about this temple, you know, being God's building a temple, and it's in process. While the temple in Jerusalem is in process, right? And as we'll see when we go through here, he alternates through chapters 1 and chapter 2, talking to the Jews and talking to the Greeks, and talking to the Jews and talking to the Greeks, and talking to the Jews and talking to the Greeks, pulling them both in. And because right before this Hebrew poetry pattern here, with about a temple being under construction while the temple in Jerusalem was being under construction, right before this, the Messiah takes out the law. And he's got to have the Jews be okay with that. Okay? So we'll take a closer look at that larger pattern and get farther along. Yeah.
Well, wasn't that the focus all the way along? I mean, it starts in Exodus with the canon of eating, etc. And it's always the temple. I mean, it's the dwelling of God, the mm-hmm. relationship with God. This
right.
is
everything. Focus. It's even here's where the tribes are with respect to that. Right. Everything is defined by here's this temple. And so now he's got to tell them, look, here's the Messiah who takes out the law. And here's the temple that's being under construction. Everything is defined by the temple. And so that's where, this is really key. And he's got to be, careful about how he builds his case and includes them and not just saying, hey, that's all a big Gentile thing. We're not having anything to do with that. Especially because the law is taken out of commission. It's like, what? You took the law out of commission? Yeah, the Messiah did it. Right? And that's why we pointed out earlier, the Messiah is one of the best kept secrets of Ephesians. 23 times. The Messiah, the Messiah, the Messiah. Okay, so let's take a look at another one. This is where both halves convey the whole. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And it just so happens there are hundreds and hundreds, between the Old and New Testament, there are hundreds and hundreds of places where heaven and earth, or heavens and the earth, together in the same verse. Okay? Hundreds and hundreds of times in the Old Testament and in the New. So here we have Genesis 1:1, the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Why doesn't it just say the universe? Why not just say, God created everything? God created the universe.
Is it like Alpha and Omega, or on top?
Like yeah, heavens and earth? Yeah, that's important. In other words, Alpha and Omega, and from A to Z is the whole, right?
Yeah.
Right. So here they've got an expression, the heavens and the earth, and that's the way they say it. And matter of fact, you'll have a real hard time finding places in the Bible where it's talking about the universe where it doesn't use heavens and the earth. It's mostly in the New Testament. Yeah.
Isn't it also giving the priorities of the two? I mean, that's what it's all about, right?
That's a good point. Let's think about this. When it says heavens, how many heavens are there in the Bible?
Three.
There's three, right? There's the atmospheric heaven, the solar and stellar heaven, is the second one, and the third one is the heaven of heavens, the third heaven, as Paul calls it, where God dwells. So there's three heavens. So when you say heavens, it's a reason for saying three, right? And so the heavens and the earth. But the third heaven, let's ask this question. Before there was a physical earth and the physical universe, right? Was there a heaven?
Yes.
Yeah, first. In other words, if you look at it, the physical realm comes entirely out of the spiritual realm, right? Right? The spiritual realm is the origin of everything in the physical realm. By the way, that's in contrast to the Greek mindset. Okay? Paul talked to the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Their mindset was that the universe in its matter was eternal and the gods could come and go. Right? So the physical universe was the basis of everything in the Greek mindset. In the Hebrew mindset, it's the physical universe is based on the spiritual. So that's why in Acts 17, the Apostle Paul goes and first corrects their worldview before he starts talking about resurrection and gospel and things like that. Right? The concept of God in the universe was wrong. And so he first goes and corrects that, and he uses Genesis 1 through 11. Okay. So now, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. 1 Chronicles 16:31, let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice. You see the Hebrew poetry pattern, and two halves make a whole, right? So let, in each one, the, and then be glad and rejoice. Those all rhyme. And then the heavens and the earth are the two halves make a whole. Here's Job 35:11. And Job is written in a great degree in poetic form, right? Who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth? Who makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens? Okay, what's similar and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens? What's similar between those two lines?
Well, there's a teaching.
Teaches
and then there's a source of knowledge.
Teaches us and makes us wiser is a part of it. Okay, and then he's got beasts and birds. How are those similar?
Both creatures.
They're both created animals, right? But then the beasts relate to the earth because they're here, and the birds are in the first heaven, right? So we have in there kind of poetic form, the Hebrew poetry pattern, poetic form, and then the two halves make the whole, the earth and the heavens, right? So that they would talk like that and write like that, okay, as common, and that's kind of the way they would think. As Gentiles, we come to that and we can see it, we can recognize it, but it isn't naturally the way we go about talking and thinking, right? But it helps to recognize, oh, that's a Hebrew poetry pattern. And even in some cases, why is there a Hebrew poetry pattern here? Okay? And especially in cases like that letter to the church at Ephesus, you know, why are you using, you know, there's value in understanding why. And we'll go into that more as we look through chapters 1 and 2 and do a full analysis of chapters 1 and 2. Let's take a look at the top of page 3. So we could give a great many more examples. The Bible has the words heavens and earth, or heaven and earth, in the same verse more than 300 times. Okay. There's another pattern that contains heaven and earth, or heaven and earth, plus a more Gentile expression. We see this when the reading or listening audience is both Gentiles and Jews. So here's Colossians 1:15-20. He, referring to Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Okay, so all creation, is that a Hebrew way of saying things? Tends to be less so, right? So it'll communicate more with the Gentiles. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on the earth. So Paul will sometimes state things in a Gentile fashion and then repeat it, which is a Hebrew poetry pattern, right? So that it fits the Hebrew pattern of speech. And he'll switch back and forth. We'll see that. We go through Ephesians chapter 2, where he first uses, in 2, 1 through 3, he first uses walk, which is a Hebrew pattern, going back to Genesis, right? And then he talks about living, and the living is a Greek term, living interactively, which the Greeks would use, right? So he talks back and forth between the cultures. And it's very carefully considered. He's not just, you know, just kind of jumping back and forth. He's very carefully considering his words. So now here we go, both the heavens and the earth, visible and invisible. So what we have here is the spiritual realm is the source of the physical realm, but is everything in the spiritual realm self-existent? No. And Kaylee's shaking her head, no, that she's right. Because God is a spiritual being, correct? Right? God is a spiritual being, but he also created spiritual beings. And so far as we know, so far as has been revealed to us, that us human beings are spiritual beings, and the angels are spiritual beings as well. Right? So visible and invisible. So God created physical, visible things, tangible things, okay? And he also created things which we can't see. Okay? And we're a hybrid, right? Because we are partly physical and partly spiritual, right? So whether thrones or dominions or rulers and authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. Okay, the all things have been created is more of a Gentile way of speaking, right? He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. All things cohere and consist, right? He is also the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. By the way, we say he's the head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. And so what does that mean? He's the firstborn from the dead.
Resurrection.
Right. And by the way, when it says firstborn, why does he use the word firstborn?
Is that going to link up to like the Roman idea of just the first son getting the benefit of?
Yeah, in other words, if you look at it, it's he's the firstborn. He could have just said he's the first to rise from the dead, right? But he also says firstborn also indicates the preeminence, right? So that he himself will come to have first place in everything. And so he kind of restates that firstborn idea. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him, and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of the cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. So he finishes it off with the Hebrew expression, whether things on earth or things in heaven. Yeah.
Is there more than one Greek word for all? Or does all always mean all inclusive?
What you have to do is look at the context to see what he's saying. Because sometimes all, he'll say all, but you say, wait a minute. He'll say all, and what he means is only those who are saved. Right? And in other contexts, it means all, you know, all inclusive, no exceptions. So I have to look at the context. And it's not because he uses a different word for all, but the context indicates otherwise. Okay? So what he's done here is he's used this heaven and earth pattern early on in Colossians 2, 1, 15 through 20, and then right there at the end. So here's the Apostle Paul. Think about it. Who is Paul? Let's think about his background and why he's able to address both of these groups. Okay, where was he born? Where did he grow
Tarsus.
Up? Tarsus. And is Tarsus in Israel?
No.
It's up in what we call Turkey. It is not too far from Antioch. Right. It is at a place where various armies, as they're kind of moving down the Mediterranean, would come through in that area, closer to the coast. It's not a coastal city. So it's Tarsus. He's Jewish. Is Tarsus a Jewish city? No. So it's Gentile. So he's a Jew in a Gentile city. As we talked about earlier, he was able, by his father's doing, to get a Roman citizenship. Okay, Tarsus is a university town, so there's a fair amount of educational sophistication. Okay, in this town, he's also trained under who?
Gamaliel.
Gamaliel, right? Gamaliel was one of the most well-respected and well-regarded rabbis of the first century. He had about 1,000 disciples. He's quoted or referenced twice in the book of Acts. And that was Paul's rabbi. So here's Paul. And Paul claims to be a Pharisee. Okay? More than once. So here's Paul. He's a Pharisee. Probably on path, had he continued, probably on path to be a member of the Sanhedrin. Okay? He would have been considered, having been trained by Gamaliel, he would have been considered a rabbi in his own right. Okay? So here's the Apostle Paul. He's got premier qualifications in the Jewish realm, he also was well qualified in the secular realm. He probably reads and writes Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Latin. Okay? Probably those four. Yeah.
So you said he, in his own right, would have been qualified to be a rabbi. Is that why he mm-hmm. had the ability to go in and get letters to slaughter the Jew,
yeah.
the Christians?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's probably at that point not quite old enough.
But he's respected enough.
But he's well regarded. It's like he's on path. Had he continued, he would be on path to be probably a member of the Sanhedrin.
Okay.
Okay. Along with the other, you know, Pharisees that were part of the Sanhedrin. So you have here, here's Paul having a good deal of sophistication. He quotes you know, poets and philosophers from, you know, centuries past. And that probably comes from his university background at Tarsus. And so he's able to do that. He writes more than any other New Testament author, with three and sometimes four-part compound words. And occasionally, the three or four-part compound words we can't find anywhere else in Greek literature of the time. Right? So this guy is writing with great sophistication. Here's another instance here. We have the two halves make a whole, heaven and earth. Now we have Jews and Gentiles, right? So here's Acts 14, 1 through 7. And this is written by Dr. Luke. And is Dr. Luke an apostle?
No.
He's not an apostle, okay? Probably is a God-fearing Gentile who became a Christian believer. Okay? So he's already a God-fearing Gentile. And Luke and Acts are probably written with that target audience in mind. A Gentile audience that has respect for the Jews and what the Jews have been taught. Right? Yes?
Where was Luke educated?
Now that's another thing. He obviously had medical background, right? Luke the physician. And so there are two primary candidates for that. One is Antioch. It was medical school at Antioch. Okay.
So that was close to Tarsus, correct?
Right. And so that's one possibility. There's another that I kind of lean towards, and that's Philippi. There was also a medical school at Philippi. One of the reasons why I lean towards Philippi is because if you go through the book of Acts, you see Paul doing we and us as they go into Philippi. And then when it's time to take off, he's not with them. Hmm. Right? He sticks around. So it tells me he's probably got something to stick around for.
Okay.
And he also uses some kind of local terminology.
Okay.
Right?
So Luke and Paul would have had more commonality than we... Like, when you first see it, you think, okay, Gentile Jew, but... With Paul's background, his educational background, he and Luke probably had more in common educationally
yeah.
that they could have communicated and related on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's amazing. We'll go through more of this, but there was one city that was famous for mirrors, right? And that's Corinth. You go to the British Museum, they've got Corinthian mirrors, you know, on display there. It's famous for its mirrors. And so Paul, you know, writes to all kinds of people, and the only two people where he includes some mention of a mirror is in both of the letters to the Corinthians. Each of them has, in 1 Corinthians 13, okay, we look through a mirror dimly, right? And then in 2 Corinthians 3:18, he uses the verb for looking into a mirror. Okay? We all with open face beholding, as in a mirror, the glory of the Lord. Okay? So yeah, he's very knowledgeable about local, you know, character and history, and amazing that, you know, the terms would, you know, he doesn't talk about adoption, which was a Roman law, begun with the adoption of Augustus Caesar by Julius. Right? He doesn't talk about adoption except for those places, well, to the Church of Rome. Or with significant Roman influence. Galatia had five major cities. Two of them were Roman colonies. Okay? He writes to Ephesus, which had a Roman governor and 3,000 Roman soldiers. Okay? He doesn't use the word adoption for just any of them. Okay? He picks where he uses it. He very carefully fits the place he's writing to. Right? Okay, so here's one. Jews and Gentiles, Acts 14. So this is the first missionary journey. This is in Galatia. This is where five of the major cities, you know, are mentioned there, and two of them are Roman colonies. In Iconium, they gathered, they entered the synagogue of the Jews together, which tells you they had, you know, more than 10 Jewish males, right, to form the synagogue, and spoke in such a manner that a large number of people believed, both of Jews and Greeks, but the Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and embittered them against the brethren. Therefore, they, spent a long time they're speaking boldly with reliance upon the Lord, who has testified to the word of his grace, granting that signs and wonders be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided, some side with the Jews and some with the apostles. And when an attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to mistreat and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to the cities of Lyconia, Lystra, and Derbe and the surrounding region. And there they continued to preach the gospel. Which addresses another question. Did the apostles pursue martyrdom?
No.
They did not. They did not pursue martyrdom. You know, hey, let's make ourselves famous and, you know, get killed. They instead postponed it as much as possible. Why? They realized they had a treasured and unique responsibility to carry out, an assignment to carry out, and that going ahead and heading towards martyrdom would cut that short. And so, it would be contrary to their stewardship. Here's Romans 3:27-30. Where then is boasting? It is excluded. By what kind of law? Of works? So these questions are what kind of question? Rhetorical questions, right? Of works? No, but by a law, or rather principle, is what I put in there. There are places where nomos is translated law, and I think a better word is principle, because it gets us off on trying to think about the law of Moses and such. For we maintain that a man is justified, declared righteous by God, by faith apart from works of the law, or is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also. Since indeed God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith, is one. And by the way, what are the circumcised and uncircumcised? Who's the circumcised? The Jews. And the Gentiles, right? And so it's another two halves make the whole. Okay? You got the whole world, according to Jewish understanding, is there's Jews and there's Gentiles, and the two halves make the whole, right? If you say Jews and Gentiles, you could say circumcised and uncircumcised, then that's all people. Okay? You have it covered. Sometimes we'll observe there's a two halves equal the whole wording of Jews and Gentiles, but Jews and or Gentiles are represented by euphemisms such as Greeks, calling them Greeks as the majority or dominant Gentile population. So let's take a look at that. 1 Corinthians 1, 20-25. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. If indeed Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block and to Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So what you see here is Jews and Greeks, Jews and Gentiles, and then back to Jews and Greeks. Okay? So he alternates between those patterns. Here's another one, land and sea. And we'll probably have to just mention it and call it good. Land and sea, plus some more Hebrew poetry patterns. So here's Psalm, here, Psalm 95, 1 through 5. O come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to him with psalms. Okay? For the Lord is a great God and a great King above all gods. in whose hand are the depths of the earth, and the peaks of the mountains are his also. So the depths of the earth is, one half is low, and the other half is the peaks of the mountains. Right? So that's another part of two halves make the whole. Is first half we got the low end, and then we got the high end. Right? They have a different idea of what's a mountain over there in Israel, by the way. So then we have, and the sea is his, for it was he who made it, and his hands formed the dry land. So you get the sea and the land, two halves make the whole. Right? So you'll see that pattern, and you'll see alternation in it, but you can look for it. I'm only going to mention the last one here, Jacob and Israel. You'll find often in the Bible, if you were to look up in some of these electronic concordances where you put in Jacob and Israel, you put those in there, very often put together, and especially in the poetic patterns, there'll be alternate between the two. Why? Israel was the name given by God, right? After Jacob wrestled, it means fighter with God, right?
Yeah. I'm just going to take a stab in the dark. Is it Jacob is the earthbound man? Israel points to the spiritual that is going to be put in place? I just guessed.
Well, it's actually analyzing that and what names are used where, it gets fairly complex because there's a lot built into that. And often Jacob and Israel, you know, both of those are used for the people of Israel, mm-hmm. right? Not just the guy, but the people of Israel. And so it'll talk about the people of Israel and use the word Jacob. Right? And then it'll talk about, and that's one reason it keeps being repeated even long after Jacob's dead, is that the people of Israel are referred to as Jacob and Israel, both. So, at the very end there, verse 4, for a statute for Israel, an ordinance for the God of Jacob. Okay? So, statute, ordinance, rhyming, right? Israel and Jacob, rhyming. Different names, but referring to the same one. Those are patterns to look for, the Hebrew poetry patterns. We're going to be looking next week at poetic patterns that are not Hebrew in character. And Paul, especially writing to the Corinthians, used both. And he used both patterns fairly frequently, breaking out into poetic patterns and sometimes into Hebrew poetry patterns. So we'll be looking through 1st and 2nd Corinthians mostly for that. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you that you have chosen to communicate your word. It is astounding to look at this book by 40 authors over a 1,500-year period of time, and yet there is so much of it that is a tightly woven fabric. And we see in that you were the author, and you had it written because you love us, because you care for us, and we just thank you for that, for your amazing grace. Amen.